The title is clunky, but the wine talk is smooth. You're listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast.
Hey everyone, and welcome to another edition of the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. And today I am interviewing winemaker Morgan Juniper, the winemaker and GM here at, I was going to say Rebel, I was talking about at 16 Mile Creek Winery. Thank you so 16
much. 16 Mile Cellar.
16 Mile Cellar. Damn it, I've already screwed it up. I don't know why I do that. Like, just I was thinking before, just because I even had the title here, but then I had like cellar, and then I have creek in my head.
You know, we're in the Creek Shores appellation of Beamsville Bench, so a lot of people will often just get all those words confused. But the 16 Mile Creek runs through our property, so that's why we're called 16 Mile Cellar.
Yeah, and I got to I was able to meet you a little while ago through a mutual friend, Andre, who's been on this pod. By the time people hear this, the Andre one will be released. And was really impressed, really enjoyed your guys' portfolio, and really appreciate you taking the time to talk.
Yeah, well, thanks for coming all the way to Niagara.
What's the challenge of being a small-scale winery? We were talking before about how you guys have a very unique experience for people who will come and drop in, but what's it like? Because you're not one of the big guys. You're one of you're a much smaller operation.
Yeah, so we're definitely one of Niagara's smallest wineries. We're in the Beamsville Bench rather than Niagara on the Lake, and I think challenges with being a small winery is just competing with the big guys. I mean, they're not our direct competition like Enniskillen, Peller, but you know they offer. Often like 5-7 days a week, you can go in and do a tasting. Whereas, you know, we only produce, just to give everybody who's listening a bit of idea to scale, small wineries in Niagara typically produce 5,000 to 7,000 cases annually. We produce 1,000 cases annually.
Jeez.
So I'm the only full-time employee. Susan and Joe Greya are the owners, and obviously their hands are, you know, in this as well. The three of us kind of work together to run the project. And I think, you know, there's like any small businesses, there's challenges, but it's kind of the ethos of who we are and what the brand is, you know, it's a boutique family run business. I'm obviously not a part of their family, but their children are also very much involved. They come to do the open houses and help around vintage. So, yeah, there are challenges, and mostly it's just trying to stand out amongst the rest. But I think also more and more people who are coming to Wine Country are looking for a unique experience, and that's kind of what we offer.
Yeah. Well, the one thing, and the tip for anyone listening, if you're just driving around or you don't have appointments, if you see that there is a couple vans outside that vineyard, just go to another vineyard. You know, come back and check, but I never like it when you go and it's packed. I'm not expecting 25 minutes with whoever's working at a winery to go over what toasting was used for the oak. But when it's the vans, that's like, okay, I'll come back in a little bit.
Yeah, well, we're sitting in our tasting room right now, and as you can see, it probably can't fit any more than 10 people at one time.
Yeah.
And we turn away buses, and not because we're trying to turn our nose up at them, but
no,
simply
we
don't have the space. And our tastings, our drop-in tastings, which are April through August every Saturday, and in the summer from June, July, August, we're going to be doing drop-in tastings from 10 to 4 on Saturday and Sundays.
Okay.
But they're with me, the winemaker, and Susan and Joe are often here. So the owners and the winemaker, you're coming in, dropping in, and you're sitting down with us. And that's a unique experience, and unfortunately, we can't really cater to large groups. I mean, we do private scheduled tastings year-round, so if people do have a larger group, 6 to 10, typically we'll be able to accommodate, but for the drop-ins, it's usually just a one-on-one with us, and it's a unique experience because we get to really talk about everything we do here and directly to, you know, our people who love our wine.
Yeah. And I mean, that is different than when you go to a larger place and the people working are often really good and they know the stuff, they know all the wines, but that's still, I mean, if you want the best entry into what a winery is all about, talking to the winemaker and the owners, you're going to certainly get more of a passion for it. Now, this was your first, was this your first vintage here at 16 Mile?
Yeah, 2018 was my first vintage here as the winemaker. And I was working overseas for, I want to say five and a bit, almost 6 years. I started, to backtrack a bit, I went, to Niagara College and did the, winery and viticulture technician program.
Yep.
And, I started working at Taz, through my practicum with Paul Pender and Renee, and, really got introduced to organics and biodynamics working there. And then from my experience there, I decided to really specialize in biodynamic winemaking and, organic viticulture. So that actually...
That helped you with when you went to Australia, right?
Yeah, exactly. It, mm-hmm. it allowed me to get the opportunity to meet David Lowe, who is a kind of a pioneer in biodynamic winemaking in Australia. He was looking for an assistant winemaker and somebody to come help get their vineyards up to organic and biodynamic certification standards. He flew me over there, sponsored me to work for him. I spent... almost 3 years there. And it was a very, very valuable experience.
All right, then let's go there. We're going to come back because I want to know what the 2018 vintage was like. But
yes.
What was it like for you? You'd finished school. You were at Taz for about a year and 8 months. Yeah. And the only reason I know that is because I went through your LinkedIn account. I make it seem I could do it like casual. Like, by the way, if it was really casual, then this would be creepy if I knew. Like,
yeah.
You don't want to know too much about someone. But what was it like? As you said, you were flown in. You've just gone from Canada, from school, Taz, flown into Australia to work for, a really, cutting edge winemaker. Mm-hmm. Take me to that first month, those first couple of weeks. What was that like?
I mean, of course, I was very nervous. Initially, when I was job hunting, the reason why I decided to go into wine is because I wanted to travel with work. So I knew once I graduated the program that I was going to do a couple of vintages abroad. And that's really what I was looking for. So when I ended up getting the job with David, a permanent job, a sponsored job, I was very surprised, but also very excited and very nervous. So, I mean, packed up anything I could that I wanted to take over in two large bags and had the support of my friends and family. And I remember flying into Sydney and seeing the stark contrast between the blue water and then just like the bright shoreline of like the sands, and thinking, holy crap, this is going to be a lot different than Canada.
Yes.
But David Lowe's winery is in Mudgee, which is kind of it's its own DVA Mudgee, but it's essentially an upper arm of the Hunter Valley.
Mm-hmm.
So I was in New South Wales, about 4 hours inland from Sydney, and Mudgee's out there. It's like a road to nowhere, really.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. Oh yeah, you're not, in some of the busier areas like Clare, Eden Valley, or things like that. You're in the middle of nowhere. What is that heat like?
Okay, so when I got there, it's funny you say that. When I flew in, my first month in Mudgee, I didn't see a cloud.
Yeah.
It was above 30 degrees for almost 30 days, and there was no clouds. The sun is so intense, and I didn't have a vehicle when I first got there. The work was, from where I was living, it was about a 12-kilometer distance, so yeah. I was biking to work every day and back, and until I, figured out what kind of car I wanted and all of this stuff, and it was kind of low on my priority list, and I'm an avid biker, so it wasn't a big deal, but I tell you, the sun, the afternoon sun is crazy, and it really kind of immediately gave me a perspective of why their wine is so unique there, mm-hmm. and why they, don't have to do as much hand modifications in the vineyard, such as leaf plucking and clearing up the canopy, because they need to shade their fruit from that sun.
Yeah.
So it was pretty interesting almost right away, starting just with,
The viticulture there, they're so different from here, where it's like, we need the grapes, especially like your Cabernets or things like that. We need the sun on that as much as possible. Mm-hmm. What a different winemaking environment that was.
Yeah. And I mean, obviously the Mudgee wine region is really small as well. So, there's a young Canadian girl coming and working with David, there was a lot of talk, and people were excited to meet me. And it's like I said, it's a very small, tight knit community. And I got welcomed and really involved right away on all aspects with other fellow winemakers in Mudgee and David and Kim. Kim is David's partner, who also runs a winery restaurant there called The Zin House. It's like a farm-to-table concept. It's really brilliant. And they are like salt-of-the-earth people. And it was such a great, great experience. And I learned so much from David. So I definitely consider him as like one of my mentors.
You have four wines here. We're going to bounce around. Yeah. I was thinking about every 10 minutes or so, we'll try one. What? Because for you guys, where you hang your hat is Burgundy. It's your Chardonnays and your Pinot Noir.
Yeah, Chardonnay and Pinot Noir. Susan, she loves Chardonnay. So it was a no-brainer that that's what they were going to plant when they bought the property. And of course, when you have a white, you need a red. And I mean, it's also known that Chardonnay and Pinot are, you know, two of the most suited varieties for our climate here. And they grow well here, and we make great wine here.
Do you want me to? I can talk for a second. As right now, you are taking the cork off, and
we're about to enjoy the 2014 Rebel Chardonnay, which is an unfiltered Chardonnay that is very fruit forward. It's been aged in neutral oak for 18 months. And it's probably one of our best sellers at this point. Right now, we have the 2014 Chardonnays is what we have on release, both the Rebel and Civility. So we're tasting the Rebel first, and next we'll be tasting the Civility. And the difference between the two is the Civility is a barrel selection.
Yeah. There's no oak on this.
No, it's it.
Because, oh, sorry. Is it neutral? Sorry, neutral oak.
Exactly. Yeah. All of our wine is aged in French oak barrels, but they're neutral oak. So we're really not looking to pull and extract those oaky flavors. We're just using that neutral oak as a vessel to gracefully age the wine.
Yeah. What do you get when you smell this? What do you get? Oh man, now you're sipping. Bad timing by me. And by the way, you can sip into it. I do it all the time. I do the tasting into the mic. I still haven't got to my perfect thought on that yet. But
it's not a thing now where people do like strange sounds into microphones.
They do. But I don't know what I want to do, because I don't want people, oh, what the hell are you doing?
So what do you think of the wine?
I have to ask. I mean, it's lovely. Is there a lot of stirring or stuff that's going on?
So in the one that we're tasting now, the Rebel,
because it has a little bit more richness than I expected from neutral.
Yes,
like there is more of a golden apple. There's a little bit of I don't want to say caramel. That's too strong, but like caramel light. Like I get a little bit.
Yeah,
and so just it there's a little more power here.
Yeah. That also speaks to the vintage as well. I mean, the Chardonnay in 2014 was able to get pretty ripe. So it kind of allows those type of flavor profiles to develop as the wine ages. In the next wine, the 2014 Civility Chardonnay, there was certainly a lot of batonnage, which is barrel stirring, but not so much in the Rebel.
Okay. There's also a really nice sort of like orange zest on the end of it.
Yeah, it's very fruit forward and has really nice structural acidity.
Yeah. And how much does this one go for?
This one is $22.95.
Yeah, that's a great price. I mean, Chardonnay is always going to usually be more expensive than a lot of the other varietals. And for that price point, you're getting a lot.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a lot. Yeah, as I said, I still get a bit of a linger on the finish on this one. So it's a really well-made wine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I really enjoy the 14s, and I think they're drinking really well right now. Also, all of our fruit that comes from the estate here is handpicked and brought in, and the Chardonnay is pressed whole cluster and fermented in barrel. So maybe as well, that richness that you're pulling from the wine, you can get that from barrel fermentation. So that's definitely something that you're probably feeling.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, let's keep jumping around. Going from Australia, how did you get from Australia to Alsace?
Well, as Most stories often start. It started with a boy.
Yep.
when I was working in Australia, I met an Alsatian guy. His name's mm-hmm. Jean, and we became really good friends, and we ended up in a relationship.
Yep.
And he's from Alsace, like I said. So I'd always any winemaker always wants to go do. You know, do a vintage or gain experience in France. It's almost like, you know, your golden ticket, like to prove your worth in the world.
By the way, actually, hold on. Just to add to that, it's so true. Like when you, if you hear the Ontario winemaker, oh, but they worked in France. In some ways, it's true. It's unfair, but it's a fact of life.
I know.
There just is. It's like
it's your the wine mecca.
Your wine cred goes up.
Yeah.
You know, even if you did very little, it was a lousy vintage, and you were at some village level place in Chablis, you were there. So that's all that counts.
Yeah. So, between my time in Australia and my year in France, I traveled all throughout Asia just because you're in that part of the world, and that's also something I wanted to do. And so Jean and I traveled through Asia together, and then we went to Alsace, and I was able to get a job with a really great natural wine producer there, and his name's Christian Binaire. And his winery is been in his family, like many wineries in France, for a couple generations. Mm-hmm. And it's just outside of Colmar in Barin, which is in Alsace. There's the two main cities: the north city, Strasbourg, and the south city is Colmar. And then Mulhouse is even further south, which is on the border with Switzerland. And anyway, I was able to work with Christian Binaire, and he produces really incredible Grand Cru Alsatian wines, Gewürztraminer, Riesling.
Yeah.
And he's also making Pinot Noir, which as of, I believe, the 2016 vintage, there will be Grand Cru status Pinot Noir coming out of Alsace.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. So it was a really interesting time while I was there, because we were, you know, there's a lot of talk and experimenting with, you know, now that there's going to be Grand Cru Pinot from Alsace, what makes that different from Burgundy, and how do they define themselves, right?
Yeah.
So a lot of that is work with foudres, which are those, the large oak oval vessels that mm-hmm. often hold up to 1,000 liters, and rather than working with barrels.
And all right. So, well, now I'm just trying to figure out what do you think is the difference? Or
well, I mean, the soil in Burgundy is very heavy with limestone, mm-hmm. and I think that's kind of quintessentially what makes Burgundy so Burgundian.
Yeah.
But in Alsace, there's a lot of gris, which is sandstone, and so it's just slightly different composition, and you know. It makes a difference, and their climate is much different. I mean, they're in Alsace; they're on the foothills of the Vosges Mountains. And they're also one of the driest regions in France.
Yeah, which
a lot of people don't know they're a northern region, wine region in France, but it's very dry there. So between the climate, the specific climate, and then the soil type, and also the vessels they use, it's all different. So it just makes it a different wine.
And what would you say if you were going to look at both Alsace, Australia, and here in Ontario for the 16-mile cellar? What would you say like is the biggest, the most unique challenge to each one of those?
That's a very good question.
Now, is it a very good question? Because sometimes when people don't have an answer right away, they say it's a very good question to stall for a moment. I do that technique all the time.
Well, I don't really know how to answer that, to be honest. I mean, like, are you wondering what the unique set of challenges are with each?
Yeah,
each
just
different...
like viticulturally, just
yeah.
Like
well,
what's...
we're all at the mercy of Mother Nature. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, wherever you are, whatever region you're working in, it provides its own subset of challenges with Mother Nature. Here in Ontario, spring frost, that's what we're scared of right now.
Yeah.
when the buds start to burst, when you get that, you know, that stupid late April cold snap,
yeah.
and your buds are already burst. And when you get a cold snap like that, it can kill some of those buds, which then you don't bear as much fruit for the rest of the year. We also worry here about cold snaps in the dead of winter. So when it gets, you know, past minus 16, you know, everybody starts to worry, because that can damage the vine very badly.
Right.
I know in the winter of 2014 was wretched, and a lot of vineyards lost you know, there was a lot of loss across the board in Niagara. In Australia, the big challenge is managing the heat and the sun. So we're dealing with really, really high temperatures, sun scald, and then a new set of challenge there, which they're also experiencing in California, are the wildfires. So you get smoke taint. And that's a big issue. In Alsace, it's managing drought because it gets so dry. But I don't know. There's something about France. It's almost like nobody worries about anything anyway. So
really,
I feel like they're not stressed out. It's just that they just accept it's just a part of the process. Whereas in the New World, we're much more
controlling,
more controlling, and a bit more worried.
Yeah, and they're more just leaf in the river.
Yeah,
see what happens. You know, it's funny. You're very uniquely like, I love your journey into wine because you went from dealing with the freezing to the super hot to a little more laissez-faire to now you're back worrying again about spring frost. That's pretty well. That's a pretty well
full circle.
Yeah, there really is. Yeah, I wonder who'd be in the middle of all of that. By the way, do you ever raise an eyebrow whenever you go visit wineries and they always just yell and scream about how Burgundian they are? Like, I always find there's a level of insecurity.
Yeah.
You're Ontario, or like when I'm in Sonoma, mm-hmm. like, oh no, we do ours the Burgundian style. If everyone says they do it the Burgundian,
then what makes us unique?
Yeah.
I mean, I definitely, I noticed that, and I've become more aware of that since I came back from working overseas. Mm-hmm. We should be talking about how Niagara, how much, you know, we represent Niagara and how our fruit speaks so well of the terroir here rather than, you know, leaning to, oh yeah, we make Burgundian wine and it's like, you know, in this way and that way. Yes, we make wine with the same sort of traditions as in Burgundy.
Of course.
Using the same varieties, using the same type of vessels. But again, what we're about here, we're not making sterilized commercial wines. Our wines are living, they're unfiltered, natural fermentation, often unfined. So what we're trying to do is, our Chardonnays aren't going to taste the same every year. Our Pinots aren't going to taste the same every year. They're going to uniquely express each particular vintage in this region. And so I think more winemakers and more retail people who are standing, you know, behind the bars when people are coming in and tasting their wine, we need to be a bit more proud of making Niagara wine, not leaning to, oh, this is Bordeaux or this is Burgundy. Just be very proud, you know, of the wine that we're making here with the fruit that is grown here.
And I want to definitely get to how each wine is different because there's a sort of a push and pull between, because that's the mission statement I've seen on the website, distinctive wines each year. And that's great. On one level, because as a winemaker, but economically, that could be tricky because there are people that crave consistency.
Absolutely.
All right, we'll go there. And then I want to talk about this terroir. I want to talk about this specific set of terroir, but how difficult, or no, it's not difficult at all. How cognizant are you of the fact that by living up to your mission statement, that can make it tricky economically?
Yeah, I think perhaps for a larger scale winery, that could definitely get tricky because, you know, I would say 90% of our sales, we rely on retail sales. So when people come in and sit down here and talk with us, licensee sales to our restaurants and our online sales. Those people already have a unique experience when they come in here because they get to sit down and talk with us. And the people who are buying online are often those people who have been in here before.
Yeah.
And our licensees, of course, we have a great relationship with, so they understand our wines. But we're not that type of winery like in Champagne, you know, they're like Dom Pérignon is looking to have a consistent wine year after year to please their customer base.
Yeah.
That's just not who we are.
Yeah, I guess you're too small for that. I mean, you might be miserable if you were the head winemaker at, say, J-Lor, where it's about, and it's, I get it. You know, when you sometimes you open up a bottle of wine, you want it to be a specific thing each and every year. You'd be miserable you might be better compensated or, you know, whatever, but I don't think you'd be as happy.
Yeah. I mean, Definitely. And that's a huge reason why I really wanted to work with Susan and Joe as well, is because I get, you know, to have my, it's a hands-on job in all aspects. I'm able to be in the vineyard. I'm in the winery. I'm out selling. I'm, you know, talking to you today. It's, I really get to understand how a small business is run. Even being small though, we could still make typical commercial wines, but it's our approach that makes us different. You know, on the website, we're zealous winemakers. We may not have the fanciest equipment and everything the most up-to-date and the most expensive, but we use what we have in order to make ourselves unique and to distinguish the wines that come from this great sub-appellation. So we're in Creekshore's sub-appellation, which is a part of the Beamsville Bench. And Creekshore's, I would say, I like to not joke, but I like to say it's the emerging sub-appellation of the bench. Often it's because there's not too many wines that are coming from this sub-appellation. There's a lot of the wineries are kind of more towards Grimsby and in Beamsville, where, you know, we're between St. Catharines and Jordan.
Right.
And we still get the effects of the bench, where the cold, the wind comes across Lake Ontario, and then it hits the escarpment and recycles back through, and it basically creates this a bit of warmth. It's just this cycle, and we still get that effect. So that's what makes us different than Niagara-on-the-Lake. But in terms of looking at what makes us different than other sub-appellations and Beamsville Bench, it's definitely our soil type. We're on the 16 Mile Creek, and our Pinot Noir vineyard, if you look at it when it's in full, you know, when there's, it's full of leaves and the foliage is, you know, it's rocking, you can see, if you were to like have a drone fly over, there's some vines and there's a pattern. It's almost like a ripple through that they don't grow as tall and the leaves aren't as dark. And that's because we have a clay, but there are ripples of sand that go through soil.
Okay.
And so that creates, you know, sandy soil, it drains better. It doesn't hold water as much. So often if we're experiencing lack of rainfall, like those are the vines that are first going to be, you know, stunted or most affected. And then, so basically my point of saying that is it's unique here because we're on a creek. It used to be a riverbed.
Yeah.
So, it's really interesting though. You know, next door, it's a totally different story. It's much heavier in clay. You go down towards, Jordan Road, and it's like really, really dense in clay, but we're still Creekshore's Appellation.
That to me is the interesting part. And it's something I was saying before we went on air. And I remember I was interviewing, Ann Sperling from, Southbrook, and I always want to ask every winemaker, what makes your little region where you grow your grapes, what makes it unique? Because, you know, getting back to your point about pride for Ontario wines, I think one thing that helps is if the wine consumer realizes it's not Ontario wine, it's not even Niagara wine. I mean, it's Niagara wine, but then within Niagara, there are going to be differences. I think that helps create a sense of that these are truly special places when we get rid of the idea that there's one monotonous sort of flavor or profile, which I always think is really important. What's the second wine? This is the next level of your Chardonnay?
Yeah, so this is our 2014 Civility Chardonnay. And as I mentioned, every year we'll do a barrel selection of the Chardonnay. And that's simply what it is. It's not always necessarily, this is the best barrel, but sometimes we pick a handful of barrels. It might only be two, it might be four. Changes every year, the volume, but often it'll be something that we can play with. So an extended aging in the barrel, more batonnage, more stirring, but usually Civility is a wine that's cerebral. It makes you think, whereas the Rebel is something just to be consumed and enjoyed. And Civility is something that for a wine enthusiast, something to kind of spark, curiosity.
Yeah. And a little sometimes inner debate within their own head about what am I drinking? What's going on here? You know, I like what you did there. People can't see it. That's the first time. You put the mic close as you were pouring the wine in the glass. That is good. Good. That is
I mean, it's
good on you.
Then people can hear just how delicious it sounds.
There you are.
So yeah, 2014 Civility.
What does, as I'm smelling this, I'll throw out a question. You don't have to answer right away because right now we're doing the smelling and tasting thing. What does structured acidity mean for you when it comes to Chardonnay?
So I think structural acidity is really important in wine. And again, going back to what makes Niagara so unique, we have cool nights and slow ripening. And that allows the acid in the grapes to, the natural acidity in the fruit to kind of retain itself. So unlike in Australia where it gets so hot so quickly, the acid drops very quick in the fruit. So mm-hmm. it's often just really sugary, juicy fruit.
Yeah.
Whereas here we get, when it ripens fully, there's still a lot of natural acidity. And through that, when you make a wine, you don't have to play with it as much because you've got a really nice balance between texture and the acidity rather than just feel like a singular ripple of acid just kind of going straight back to your tongue. Mm-hmm. You feel it all throughout your mouth. You get the structural acidity in the middle of your tongue. You can feel it in your cheeks as you salivate, and you get it on the finish. And it's just very structured. And that's something I just love about Niagara wine. And I could probably pick a Niagara Chardonnay in a blind tasting no problem because that's like a trigger for me, the structural acidity.
Yeah. This is beautiful. I don't want to go, it's like the rebel, but more.
Exactly.
That would be a gross, that'd be a bit of an oversimplification mm-hmm. of it, but.
Every time I have this wine, I think of lemon tarts. Mm-hmm. That the meringue on top, that kind of, and it's a lot of people say, oh, it's creamy. It just has a nice length and a nice broadness to it. Perhaps the creaminess comes from that stirring. So I often tell people when they come in, what are you exactly stirring? Mm-hmm. If you think of orange juice, when you get it with pulp and the pulp settles to the bottom, the same thing happens with wine in barrels when it's aging, but instead of pulp, we call it lees. Mm-hmm. And so that lees settles to the bottom of the barrel. And what we'll do is we go in and we stir that up and you get that lees back into suspension. And what that does is it suspends those solids and then brings a lot more complexity back into the wine. Sometimes you can do it too much and not every barrel is suited to be stirred. But
and then it gets just too big and overwhelming if
exactly.
you stir too much.
And especially if you're using other components like brand new oak or, you know.
It feels like sometimes that's an apology for your grapes or for your juice. If you overstir, it's like, okay, we don't have the best juice, so let's just mask whatever imperfections with power and help people just
and
enjoy.
And then that often goes totally wrong because if you stir too much, then you're just heightening the imperfections.
Yeah.
So
is the foot the greatest tool that a winemaker has?
I use my feet definitely here because we do small batch, right? Mm-hmm. So our ferments, we ferment, you know, in smaller vessels, maybe 1-ton vessels. So I can get in there with my hands and feet and with the reds specifically. The whites ferment in barrel. Mm-hmm. But the reds, I mean, we bring them in whole cluster if we can. And when they're fermenting, rather than using pumps or big stainless plungers, I just get in there and slowly massage the cap with my hands and my feet. And that means for a gentle extraction. There's like nothing more gentle than human touch. So
yeah, you're not using some big just punch down to do it.
And I do make sure I hose myself down before I get in there, just in case people think I have my dirty feet.
Yeah, no one's going to be like, you know, you're not going to do like a 50K bike ride, come back and then immediately hop into the barrel.
Yeah, and a lot of people, you know, would just imagine like the I Love Lucy, you mm-hmm. know, in there, you know, stomping away. It's less about stomping and more about gently pressing because we want to just slowly extract all of that stuff. Yeah. If you over extract, it just becomes a hard tannic wine, but we'll get into that when we try the reds.
Yeah. And a little more, there's a little more tropical mm-hmm. On this. There's a little bit of spice. Because I'm always careful. I don't want to go like brown sugar. Because if I say brown sugar, that's going to make it seem like it's this big sweet thing. And it's not at all. But there's
this
light,
like candied
faint
pecans.
What's that?
Like a candied pecan. Like something like.
Yeah, the candied notes. Like that's where I'm sort of trying to. Yeah. No, that's lovely. What made you get into wine?
I was in working. So I was working in marketing and sales. And honestly, I was really, I just wasn't happy working in an office.
Yeah.
And I was in my early 20s and I wanted to do more traveling. But I didn't want to just like wander aimlessly in backpack without a rhyme or reason. So I thought, you know what? Why don't I get into wine and I can travel with wine? I'd always loved wine.
And where did that come from?
Honestly, not my parents. That's for sure. Like my parents were never really big drinkers. My mom likes wine, but she likes Pinot Grigio from Italy, and that's just about it.
Oh yeah, my same thing with my mom. I always joke if she stopped drinking, then the entire northeast of Italy would have to reconsider their entire economy.
My mom as well. but I mean, they were always, you know, supporting me 100% with, okay, well, you should just, if you're passionate about it, you should go after it.
Mm-hmm.
So my original plan was, oh, I'll, you know, become a sommelier and I'll work in restaurants around the world. And then a friend of mine told me about the Niagara College program. And I just kind of thought, you know what, it'd be great to learn everything about wine. And from that, I really got into production, like the production of wine and viticulture.
Yeah.
And really after working at Taz, I just kind of knew that this is what I wanted to do.
And was there, so there was no like sort of little epiphany moment. There was no where it was one wine or there was one night or something like that.
Well, honestly.
Because for everyone's got their own origin story.
Yeah. I mean, when I was 16, I guess I was showing up to parties with Beaujolais.
Yeah.
And
hey, better than the White Zinfandel.
Yeah. And I mean, people would be wondering why I had a bottle of red wine rather than a Mickey of vodka.
Yeah.
And I just always liked wine.
Yeah.
And I just thought, you know what? Like, I could probably turn this into a passion.
Mm-hmm.
So that's just how it all happened.
Oh, that's fantastic. And so your folks not huge into it.
My dad, I've introduced my dad into the world of wine. And
yeah.
He does enjoy it now. And he likes, you know, drinking wine with me and listening to me talk about it. And
yeah.
So does my mom. But my mom definitely, anytime she comes over, she was here this week, I make sure there's a nice cold bottle of Pinot Grigio in the fridge.
It's funny. You and I are the exact same way. My mom is the same way. Like, she loves my passion for it, especially, you know, all the years studying it and traveling around. Every now and then, there will be an eye roll when I'm describing the salty minerality at the end of this Riesling or something, and she's like, "What are you talking about?" And she's like, "My glass is near empty. We need to fix this."
Yeah.
What are you drinking now? Like, what? Everyone goes through little shifts and stuff. What right now is getting your attention?
Well, I've been doing right now. Susan, Joe, and I have been working on final blends for the 2017 vintage. So,
yep.
As I've been kind of tweaking how we want to, you know, pick the barrels and what we want to do for blending, I've lately been drinking a ton of Niagara Pinot Noir. So I'm just drinking as much Pinot as I possibly can to understand, especially those wineries that have already bottled their 2017s.
Yeah.
I want to kind of use those as benchmarks. So at the moment I'm very Pinot heavy.
Yeah. Nice.
Flat Rock actually do a really nice Pinot Noir.
Flat Rock?
Yeah. They're, I'm not sure if it's the estate or what exactly it's called, but it's the, in like the $20 to $25 category.
Mm-hmm.
Really good for value. And I've always loved Hidden Bench Pinots. So that's kind of what I'm drinking at the moment. I mean, as summer rolls in, it's going to be rosé season.
Yep.
And lots of bubbles. I really enjoy sparkling in the summer.
By the way, Will, which one of the Rebel Pinot, there's 13 and 12, which one do you want to pull
first?
I
think we'll start with the 2012. So I love, this is like one of my favorite things to do when people come in to do a tasting. Pinot Noir is, it's the heartbreak grape. It is crazy. It's difficult to manage, but when you can make a great Pinot, it's like, oh, you feel like you're on top of the world.
Yeah.
And it's so different every year. It's the most, it's the variety, in my opinion, that is the most susceptible to its environment. So it's very sensitive. You have to baby it. You have to watch it. You have to, you know, always be monitoring it in the vineyard and in the cellar. And the 2012 and 2013 vintages couldn't have been more different. 2012 was very, very hot and dry. I know this firsthand because I was working in the vineyard in 2012 at Taz, hand hoeing under the vines.
Hoeing, that sounds like that is hard work.
Yes, it was incredibly difficult, but you know, you get a huge appreciation for the amount of labor that goes into organic viticulture. Mm-hmm. But yeah, so it was, I just remember it being really, really hot. And all of the varieties, the red varieties, specifically in the vintage of 2012 in Niagara, were very ripe.
A lot of perfume.
Yeah. And so this is, right now we're tasting 2012. Actually, this was made by Thomas Batchelder.
Oh, okay.
So Thomas made the wines for Susan and Joe in 2010, 2011, and 2012. So it's kind of nice because as I've, you know, started working here, I'm getting to explore all the different, you know, wines and different vintages, and I'm getting to sell Thomas's wines. I'm getting to sell Reagan's wines, and it's...
And for people who don't know, Thomas is... He's one of the more famous winemakers here in Niagara. And just consistently producing, you know, some kick-ass shards, and just he's a really good winemaker. So yeah. Just for people who don't know who that is.
And so this again, this Pinot is really expressing those quintessential characteristics of mushroomy, deep fruit, round, smooth tannins. But still has aged incredibly well in the bottle.
Mm-hmm. For usually just in New World, and you don't often get, I mean, 7 years is a second in mm-hmm. France. In New World, it's certainly, you know, that's not as common. You're right about the mushrooms.
Yeah.
Absolutely the mushrooms. And also this wine has many, many more years left in it.
I know. It's and that's just all thanks to the weather
in
2012. I mean, it made the... Yeah, it was the perfect storm for a full-bodied Pinot that can certainly hold its own throughout the years in bottle. But drinking really well right now, I mean.
Yeah.
This is probably our best... this is our best seller right now for licensees. The restaurants love this wine because it has a lot of depth and it's very food friendly.
Mm-hmm. And I think for some people who get nervous, like people that are getting into wine, like, oh, Pinot, I don't like it when it's too light. I'm like, okay, well, come here. Like this would be perfect. This would be a great entry level Pinot for people.
Yeah.
Just in the sense that it still has the delicacy. It's not like some Sonoma Coast Pinot, which you swear that they've blended 15% Syrah in it, but they're just not telling you. But there is enough power here. For just someone who's just starting to get into it. What was 18 like? I remember I wanted, because it was your first vintage here. I mean, how was that? I mean, did you worry a little bit extra because you're now winemaker and GM here at 16 Mile?
Yeah, of course there's a bit of anxiety, but I mean, there's anxiety for every winemaker every year. I guess it was just a little bit extra for me because, yes, it was my first vintage at 16 Mile. And in fact, my first vintage as a head winemaker. So,
congrats for that, by the way.
Thank you.
Well deserved.
Yeah. So it's a lot of pressure, but I was confident because, I mean, our contract vineyard manager, Bill Baranek, he does a great job. He lives just down the street. So he's always, you know, checking in on the vines. Nothing gets neglected here. I mean, when I walked my first week here, as I was walking through the vineyards to kind of get familiarized, the Pinot Noir was hanging perfectly. I mean, all the bunches were evenly spaced out. Nothing was too crowded. Clusters were nice and loose. We had great weather, and everything was ripening really quickly. So I was able to get the Pinot off the vine, mid-September, mm-hmm. and I don't know if you remember, but at the mid-end of September in 2018, we had a wicked, wicked heat wave. So it was like 35 degrees, 100% humidity, and we had our fruit off the vine just in the nick of time before that heat wave, which I couldn't have been more thankful for because
Sorry to interrupt. You're probably going to say that. It's good for people that are, you know, aren't too sure because it's mm-hmm. a wide range of people to listen. What would have happened if you had left them on for another week?
Yeah. So what happens is with the high heat and humidity, especially when the fruit is ripe or just about ripe, it basically splits the skins of the berries because it gets very, the berries become very swollen because of the high heat and high humidity, mm-hmm. and then it bursts the skins. And then what happens is you get the fruit flies coming in, and then that creates sour rot. So it spoils the fruit.
Okay.
And then what happens then if your fruit isn't ripe enough and you have to leave it on the vine through all of this heat, then you have to pick it and you have to hand sort out all of that rot. And it can be a nightmare. 2017 was a particularly tough vintage for everybody in Niagara. I shouldn't speak of all of Niagara, but Beamsville Bench for Pinot was tough because of a lot of rain and high heat. But in 2018, it was a relatively cool, it was a normal summer. It was a bit dry, but then we'd get some rain when we needed it most. And it wasn't too hot, and then we'd have cool nights. So for me, it was like, I was just so happy 2018 was my first vintage here because our fruit was really clean.
Yeah.
The wines are tasting great. I mean, our Pinot Noir, the 2018 Pinot in barrel right now is just tasting fabulous. So as long as we, shepherd it through its journey, I think we'll be pretty happy with our end result.
And what does that mean, shepherding through the journey? What are the most important things for you?
Well, making sure that the barrels are always topped up. So over time, you get evaporation in the barrels. So you end up creating a bit of headspace. And mm-hmm. you want to make sure that you're not leaving that headspace there for too long. So I have, a little tank filled with wine that I use to once every month or every, 6 to 8 weeks. I go and I fill that space up in the barrel, making sure that's like, in my opinion, that's the most important part through élevage, through wine aging.
Yeah.
And then also tasting, sometimes because again, our wines are living, we don't, over refine them or, we're not intervening too much. You need to just check up on them. How's it doing in this barrel? Sometimes a barrel will taste off and you have to get it out of there and put it in a different one. Maybe it's the oak isn't reacting well with it. Maybe the barrel's, had its time and it needs to be retired. And then also sometimes you get drops in pH. And so you need to just keep your eye on it.
Yeah, keep your eye on the prize. Mm-hmm. What would you say is the hardest challenge in terms of selling Niagara wine? Because the one thing I always hear is like BC, it's a lot easier for BC winemakers to sell their wine to people from British Columbia versus Ontario. It seems that it's a little more work.
Yeah, it's a tough question because it can get quite personal for some people. Often, a lot of people would lean on the crutch of, well, it's because we have to deal with the LCBO. Mm-hmm. It's tough to sell wine because there's a lot of limitations on how we can do it. Wineries are lucky, like breweries, when you produce on site, you can have a retail license. So you're able to sell through your restaurant or your either your restaurant or your cellar door, your yeah. retail space. But I think, in my opinion, the biggest challenge of selling Niagara wine is the wine culture in Ontario is still relatively young. A lot more people there's more people drinking wine in Ontario than ever before, which is great.
Yeah.
But, when I came from France, wine is embedded in their culture. It's just a part of their everyday life. And, you've got local people who have their favorite local winery. So when I was working with Christian, you've got people coming in that live in that village and that's just where they get their wine.
Yeah.
And also they're able to, sell all throughout Europe much easier.
Yeah.
Technically, I can't even ship wine outside of Ontario.
That's nuts.
So
it's crazy.
I get people who contact us all the time, like from British Columbia or Alberta, and wanting a private order, want me to send a case out, and I just can't.
Yeah.
So I mean, that makes it very difficult, and mm-hmm. There's also I believe that what I would like to see is for eventually there to be licenses given out for independent retailers to open their own wine shops. Everywhere else I was in the world, you go around and in every neighborhood, there's a wine shop and
yes.
you go in and it's the person who owns it. It's their particular flair and you can go in for wine education. You can, and it would, I think it would be great if we had that here. And what would make it work, I think, for everybody is those wine shops can only sell things that are not available in the LCBO. So it wouldn't be directly competing with, you know, what we currently have to offer.
First off, preach. And we'll try the last one, the 13. I'm sorry. I think I over-poured in your glass.
No, that's fine.
But when I was, I'll let you do the pouring because you're better at it than I am. When I was in Naples, Florida.
Yes.
To me, it's the perfect model. You can get it at the grocery store, but you have the giant Total Wine, which is like your LCBO. Mm-hmm. Tons of selection. They have good people working there, and you can get some competitive prices because they buy in bulk.
Yeah.
But what they also had, and Naples isn't a huge city, they also always have one or two specialty, where it's the owners, this is what they love. And when winemakers are coming into town, they'll give a little demonstration of their wines. They'll do all these things. And yeah, I wish Toronto had this. Mm-hmm. You know what I'd love to see? I'd love to see just a store, and all they do is specialize in Burgundian.
Yeah.
So here's our 12 different shards from all around the world. Here's our 20 different Pinots, and do it like that. I think the customer in Ontario, we would all benefit so much from that.
And I feel like, the wine drinker would benefit from that, and it would create better wine culture as well.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
A lot of people are intimidated when they go into the LCBO because there's so much selection. They don't know what to pick, so they just go to what's familiar. So even when, you know, we do get the opportunity to sell some of our wine into the LCBO, often it's just lost amongst all of
it's
the other labels.
It's just a sea of everything else, yeah. And it also, I think it would help with just the prestige if there was the little independent store. And then winemakers would have a better job telling their stories if you had the little stores out there. And I'm not talking about the wine rack where it's only about two or three giant conglomerate Ontario wines. I'm like, I don't want the wine rack that serves no
purpose.
And it's
funny, a lot of people don't really understand is that in those stores, like the wine rack, they're really only, two big conglomerate, two big wineries that are in that store selling their wine, but they see so many different labels. Well, that winery is making all these sub-labels, you know, but it's essentially coming from one giant place.
Yeah.
So it would be really nice to be able to see a bit more flair and diversity. And I mean, if I wasn't a winemaker, well, if that was allowed in Ontario, I bet I would have just thought, okay, I love winemaking, but I love wine.
Yeah.
And I think for me, like a dream of mine would, to be my own, have my own little private cellar shop and just be able to import what I want and not be directly competing with the LCBO. And then people can come in and they can learn about wine in a carefree way and not feel intimidated.
But it could be a relationship between the two. Mm-hmm. And people that come into your store and we'll go halvesies on it. Then they might start to love wine more. And guess what? If you love wine more, eventually you're going to find yourself at the LCBO. Like,
it
can be mutually beneficial. The final wine, the 2013. And this is what I appreciate. They are so different.
They're totally
like
different.
On 12, I got more power and I got this more perfume right off the top. Mm-hmm. This one,
I like to describe this one as the ballerina.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, so 2013, unlike 12 where it was very hot and dry, 13 was cool and wet. So it creates a bit of a lighter profile, a bit more delicacy, especially with the tannin. Mm-hmm. The acidity is less structural and just more bright and apparent. And it's more, the fruit profile on this is cranberries, cherries, strawberries, rather than dark fruit and mushroom of what we're getting off the 12. It's speaking of the vintage in 13 where it wasn't as ripe. The berries were bigger and the skin was less thick because of the conditions, and it just created this different wine. And then people who really love fun, light, fruity wines love this Pinot.
Yeah, but it's, there is depth here. But
absolutely.
Yes, it is lighter. It is more bright. And that's what I love. This is what you want from wine. It's one thing I appreciated from a lot of the wineries here, like Pearl Morset or 13th Street or like all these different ones, where it's like every year it's going to taste different. There will be some things that are the same, but it's going to have its own personality. And that's kind of what I think what every winery should, I mean, except for the couple giant ones, all the wineries should strive to have every year have a different personality. Mm-hmm. Thank you very much for doing this, by the way. I really appreciate it.
I'm so glad you came out. I'm glad you got to see the vineyards and my my lazy wine dog who's...
Yep, there's Archie.
Beside me over here. He'll be in the wine dog calendar 2020.
Yes, he's very cute. So for people, again, promote once again for 16 Mile sellers here. Where give the information, websites, phone numbers, where to come, all that kind of stuff.
So www.16mileseller.com, 16mileseller.com. We're very active on Instagram and Facebook. So you can follow us on Instagram at 16 Mile Seller. And we are having a spring open house for those who are in the area and interested in coming by on May 4th. It's going to be from 11 a.m. to 3 p.m. You can come in. We're going to be pouring new releases. Joe's going to be giving some vineyard tours. Susan and her kids, Matthew and Emma, will also be here pouring. And it's a chance for people to come in, see the cellar, meet us, and take a tour of the winery. But if you can't make it for May the 4th, again, starting in April, every Saturday from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m., I'll be here. And you can drop in and come say hello and have a chat with me, taste, purchase wine. And June, July, August, it'll be Saturdays and Sundays.
Perfect. Morgan, thank you so much. Congratulations on your first vintage.
Thank you.
I'm looking forward to see what you continue to do, as you've had a pretty interesting wine career already, and it seems like it's just starting.
Great. Thank you so much.
Cheers. Thank you so much. Cheers. Thanks, everyone, for listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Remember, you can get it, rate, review, download, Stitcher, Spotify, iTunes, and wherever quality podcasts are sold.
Thanks for listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Happy hunting.